This is One-on-One with Jasper Cole, Hollywood's bad guy, and so much more. Actor, talent manager, producer, and more. Now he's sitting down with today's top newsmakers from entertainment, politics, pop culture, and beyond. This is One-on-One with Jasper Cole.
Howdy, 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 and welcome everyone to One-on-One with Jasper Cole. This is your host, Mr. Jasper Cole, and we are coming to you live from Blog Talk Radio right here in Hollywood, California. Everyone, please follow us on social media. One-on-One J. Cole is on Twitter and Instagram. Also, Jasper Cole Says, S-A-Y-S, on Twitter and Instagram. You can go to my Facebook page on Jasper Cole, and then if you go to the website, JasperCole.com, there is a link for One-on-One with Jasper Cole, and it will take you to all of the archive shows that we have. Tonight, I am solo because my trusted co-host and producer, Mr. John Williams, is back in Ohio. As you know, his mom is has been ill, and he went home to be there with her. But he sends everyone his best. And of course, so tonight, the inmates are running the asylum. It's Jasper running the board into the ground. No, I'm kidding. That's not going to happen. And so what if it does? I've got an amazing guest coming up. This is actually a reschedule from a few months ago, or actually maybe longer. I apologize. We were supposed to do an interview and I had to cancel, but this guy, Dustin Ferguson, is so busy. I'm surprised he even had time to come talk to us tonight. He is a producer, a director, a writer. He's owned his own distribution companies. I mean, there's pretty much, I don't think there's anything this guy doesn't do. He is a client of our wonderful friend, Mr. Joe Williamson, and we've been wanting to get him on the show and talk to him. So I think we have him now. So I'm going to see if we, is Dustin, are you there? Is this Mr. Dustin?
It is.
Hey, buddy, how are you?
Great. How are you?
We're giving you real applause here. You deserve it.
I appreciate it.
I appreciate you taking the time. I know how busy you are. Welcome to the show. Everyone, if you want to call in, it's 563-999-3025, and we can take some calls from Mr. Dustin Ferguson. Well, congratulations, first of all, on all your hard work and accolades and everything that you have going on.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So I want to talk to you. Well, I see that you're from Kansas. So I guess the obvious question is, how does a nice boy like you from Kansas end up wanting to do horror films in Hollywood? How did all this start for you?
Well, it's interesting. Actually, I was born in Kansas, raised in Nebraska, and I lived in Nebraska until about 2 years ago.
And, oh, wow.
Yeah, so I'm fresh here in Cali, actually. I grew up just a fan of horror films because my parents were. You know, I was a child when VHS was the popular format, so my parents had a VHS collection of, you know, Night of the Living Dead and Alice Sweet Alice and Day of the Trippin'.
Oh, God. The classics, yeah.
So that's what I grew up on. And so naturally, you know, I became a fan and began collecting horror films myself. And around when I had about 6,000 horror films, I actually opened up my own video store in 2017 that specialized in horror and exploitation films. And it was actually selling. I had the store for 11 months and ended up selling it to a guy that was a regular customer that began supplying posters to my business, who ultimately became my screenwriter for Nemesis 5 and Robo Woman and several other films. He bought the business from me and I moved out here to Cali.
Well, you know, Dustin, this is amazing because I wrongfully assume, you know, like you have to be here in Hollywood. And we had Bill Oberst Jr. on my last show and we were having this whole conversation and I'd love to get your take on it. I mean, you're obviously an example of you don't have to be in Hollywood to create, you know, content and make movies. That's the beauty of today's industry. What made you want to end up here, to leave Nebraska? And I mean, you have almost 70 if not more, credits already. So it's amazing that you did all of this in Nebraska.
It is, and that's why I'm here now.
I had run your course in Nebraska?
No, that's exactly what it was. Nemesis 5 was my 50th feature, and it was the last movie that I shot in Nebraska. And I was actually on set. It was maybe the second or third day we were filming, and it was like an epiphany. It just hit me. I was like, I have to go to L.A. Like, what am I doing here? You know, I've done 50 movies. I'm still working two jobs to pay my bills. I'm going in circles. I mean, I was creating content, and I was providing opportunities for people there in the industry, but it wasn't – I was just going in circles. I wasn't getting anywhere. I wasn't getting richer. I wasn't getting more famous, really, or any of that.
Right.
You know, what can you do from Nebraska? So it was just like, you know – my vision, I think everybody before they come to LA, they picture LA as this big, scary, intimidating place, and the people are mean, and it's dirty, and all this stuff. But what I had never considered was I don't have to live in LA to still work in LA.
Right.
So I live in a really nice town in Southern California that's beautiful and gorgeous, and it's very inspiring for me creatively, and I've never been happier. And it's, to me, it seems like looking back, this was such a natural transition that, like, of course I was going to end up here, and of course I'm going to be doing this for the rest of my life. But before 2 years ago, I couldn't even imagine it.
Well, what's amazing is I know actually where you live, and you're right. And, you know, I moved out to Palm Springs for the exact same reason of – but the irony is it took me 30 years of being in L.A. to realize, you know, Jasper, you can actually move outside of L.A. and have a better quality of life. But and you're so young. I mean, you're not even 40 yet. And so what's great about you, though, is you arrived in L.A. already seasoned. You know, so many people come to L.A. wanting to start. And so what a great advantage you already had, having had.
And I didn't even realize that. Yeah, I didn't even think about that. You know, like, I thought I had barely just enough. You know, that was what, because in my mind, I tell Joe, my manager, this all the time. Like, he's constantly telling me that I'm bigger than I think I am. Because to me, I'm like, when someone comes up to me and they'll talk to me about a movie of mine, I think they're lying. You know, I'm like, you haven't seen that. Nobody's seen that. You know, and so it's like, I didn't really realize that doing 50 films and showing up to LA with that under my belt is going to get me so much work. Like, that's what the people here look for. They want turnaround. They want to make sure you follow through when you have a track record and people say good things about you. You just get all the work. And I didn't expect that. I thought I would come here and it would be like, everybody says it's going to struggle. It may not last longer than 3 months and who knows what's going to happen. But the moment I got here, I've been fighting people off with a stick. I mean, like you said yourself, I'm so busy and I never thought that that would happen.
I love to hear these stories because, you know, like you said, we hear the old cliche of the other part. And I love the fact that you sort of, you know, got your footing and did your work in Nebraska before you got here. And first of all, big shout out to Joe Williamson, your manager, because we love him. And he is such a supporter of talent. And boy, when he gets behind somebody, he's behind you 100%. So he's
really
amazing.
Is. He's the best person in my life, really.
And again, he has a great passion for the genre. Now, so I think it's fascinating, too, that your parents were horror fans because, you know, again, I'm a good bit older than you, but I was of a generation where, you know, we were having to, like, you know, sneak away sometimes to watch the classic horror films or we didn't tell our parents. You know, they thought it was too gruesome.
And it's funny because I still had to – that was my punishment was the thing. They knew that because they had raised a horror fan that if I was in trouble, they would take away my horror movies or I couldn't watch a movie that was rated R. And so it was funny because it actually affected me kind of the rest of my life when this happened. I remember one summer – I can't even remember what I did. I got in trouble and I wasn't allowed for a while to rent R-rated movies. So what I did was I rented unrated movies. Because your parents don't know what unrated means.
They don't know
that's necessarily worse than an R rating. So, like, when I was 11, 12 years old, I was running movies like Faces of Death and Blood Diner and Cannibal Holocaust and stuff that, like, kids are not supposed to be watching because I got my R-rated privilege taken away.
Right,
and so it's funny because I think ultimately being exposed to that stuff at a young age, you know, and being the creative person I am, I interpreted it different and it really – it's just sort of like grew my love and appreciation of the genre as a whole. I wasn't just watching Freddy and Jason growing up. I was watching European cinema and African horror films and, you know, all the stuff that you don't really normally discover until you're older.
Until you're older, right. What a blessing that was for you. Now, what was your very first project that you did? I mean, in terms of your first official feature that you did in Nebraska?
Okay, well, there's kind of like, it's like a three-step answer here, because the first thing I did that broke me into the industry was I was the editor of Sleepaway Camp 4. And that was,
okay.
That's a franchise title, so that got me out there. But the first thing I ever shot was a short film called Scalps 2, and it was a sequel to Fredo and Ray's 1983 Scalps film that he actually watched and officially released on his Blu-ray of the original film. So that also got me out. But my first feature was in 2009, and it's a movie called Terror at Black Tree Forest. And I just announced, I released this morning a poster because it's being rebooted and it has a British remake.
I wanted to get to that. Congratulations. Yes, that's exciting. Now, because going back, you know, you really are known, quote unquote, I know you don't think you're known, but you are known for doing the sequels and the remakes of these classics horror films.
Right.
And so, you know, there's a company, Asylum. I don't know if you know Asylum,
yeah.
but,
you
know, they're kind of, Yeah. I mean, shout out to David Ladd and all of them, and I've worked for them. But, you know, they sort of put themselves on the map, sort of more doing the mockumentary. You know, they sort of.
Yeah, mockbusters. Yeah.
They would do more of the mockbusters, but yours were more homage, right? They were more.
Yeah.
How would you categorize? Yeah.
Yeah, like you said, an homage. I kind of. It's weird because I don't think I realized that until even more recently that. I always have this tradition of doing sequels and reboots and stuff. I think just because of my fan being a fan of the genre, I want to, you know, this. When I first started making movies, I never intended on anybody seeing them. The first three movies I made, I intended to make them and watch them myself. I actually had friends beg me to do a public screening for my first movie, Terror at Black Tree Forest. I agreed, and that's how my stuff started getting out. And I was literally selling copies of the trunk of my car in the parking lot there. And
God.
I never, you know, I didn't do this to get out there. I did this for myself because I was like, you know, horror's changed so much. I want to go back to making movies the way they used to when they were good. And so my intentions were to make a movie as if it was still 1993. You know, like I have
right.
an old style
right.
of doing it. The takes are longer. We have wide takes. The acting's a notch above the amateur acting because I make them, you know, deliver the lines with compassion. We have good locations, all of that. Because I'm trying to keep it alive, you know. And
I
never really saw that as like the way I do things until I noticed a transition because I do my own post art. So I kind of do everything with my stuff.
You do.
So,
you
like,
do it my, all. I mean, literally.
Yeah, like with the posters, I started homaging older horror films with the design because the films themselves are homages. That's sort of just what my style has become. And I think I've created a niche market of people that want movies the way they used to be for real. Not these Hollywood, like, oh, Hatchet's like a throwback slasher, but like a real 80s style, low budget Killer in the Woods movie. You know, like no one's doing that.
Aren't you? I mean, Death, I mean, I've dipped my toe in horror. You know, I've been lucky to do some horror
films.
You're
in the 13th Eight.
I know, but I was cut out. But anyway, I know it doesn't matter how many times I say that. People, I shot it, so whatever. But no, it's you know, I'm always amazed at the fans and also like you said, the passion that like people have for horror, and they know their movies, they know the actors, they know the history.
Yeah.
of it. And I think that's just something, like you said, that starts really young for a lot of people. You know, it's something that they click on early. And you, so it's interesting too, because you have all these talents. And so would you say you are self-taught? I mean, we're all basically self-taught, taught, but you know, in terms of
I didn't go to
making
film
posters,
school or anything.
Right.
Yeah, no, definitely. I actually, when I had done, before I did Sleepaway Camp 4, what actually got me that was I was a fan editor. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but there's a whole community on the internet. Yeah, people that do fan edits of like Star Wars movies where they take deleted scenes and put them back in or they create their own preferred version. So I was doing that with horror films. I had done over 100 fan edits that I put out for free on the internet under the name Retro Horror Remix, and I had a whole fan base of those. And so there's a guy, John Klasa, in Australia who had discovered me that way, and he was the one that had the rights for Sleepaway Camp. So he hired me based on my passion and my free editing jobs I was doing to edit that film. And that's actually kind of what the passion itself is, literally what got me into the industry.
Amazing. If you're just joining us, we're talking to the iconic, truly iconic at 37 years old, Mr. Destin Ferguson. And we are talking all things horror today, and especially somebody who does it all, which is amazing to me. And that's what, you know, I'm big on that too. I tell actors all the time, you know, don't just sit by the phone and wait for to ring. You got to create your opportunities. And so, and tell everyone that's listening, where can they stalk you? No, I'm kidding. Where can they follow you on on social media or your website? You know, all that good stuff.
Okay. Well, honestly, I have just a regular Facebook page under Dustin Ferguson. I keep it public. Anybody can friend me, you know, and talk to me there. I have a director's page that is only Dustin Ferguson. It's all one word. And then I have an Instagram that's the only Dirty D, but that's focused mostly on my rap career. So if you want the horror stuff, it's more on Facebook.
Right. We haven't even gotten to the rap career. I mean, God, let's see. You're just adding more and more. You're not Jamaican. Someone said to me the other day, Jasper, are you Jamaican? I'm like, no, I just need to make money. I just have bills. I'm a money whore. I have bills to pay.
Yeah.
But no, so in terms of acting, in terms of how you find your actors, do you hold casting sessions? Is it mostly offers? Do you go through referrals?
I've only done one true casting session, and it was for the Shark movie last summer because it was a very big project. But typically, when I was in Nebraska, you know, it was very close-knit. And so it started out with, like, you know, friends and family being in the movies, and it sort of grows a little bit. And then you kind of have, like, a group of people that are kind of, like, in all the movies. So I sort of had, like, 20 to 30 actors, you know, that I kind of went between for all the different films. And so when I came to California, what's been interesting is that I've sort of had to rebuild all that here, like make the new connections, new friends, people that are in this with me. But additionally now, a lot of the people from Nebraska are flying out here on their own dime to still be in my movies.
I love
so
that.
It's like,
well, that's
yeah,
very,
got, like,
that
an overwhelming
a lot.
Amount of it. Yeah.
That says a lot about you. Well, I love that. You know, you have a very Quentin Tarantino vibe to you in the sense that, you know, Quentin worked in video stores Quentin had a passion for the business early on, and he kind of just lived and breathed it. And you know, and he likes to work with the same people. A lot of directors that I admire, they do sort of have a repertoire. You know, Scorsese has his core people. We could go down the list of directors. Were there or are there? Well, first I'll say in the horror genre, were there the Wes Cravens or people's work that you looked up to as a director?
When I first started, well, I mean, you know, I was a fan of all sorts of different types of horror, but I think that what I found most inspirational was the real low-budget stuff, like the rural horror that was being made in, like, Kentucky, you know, like people like William Girdler, the Three on a Meat Hook, and movies that are just more obscure that you could tell that they were pooling their resources and pulling off a Midwest feature, you know, because that's where I was. And so that, at the time, was the sort of stuff that inspired me. But as I've grown as an artist and I have more artistic, I guess, an artistic flair to the films and higher production quality, I would definitely say that people like Dario Argento and John Carpenter are my two biggest inspirations.
Yes,
John Carpenter, because he taught me the importance of music in film, because without the soundtracks in his movies, they wouldn't be half as good. They are very reliant on the mood that the music creates, and that's so important to me. All my movies are very reliant on the soundtrack. And then with Argento, he's the person that taught me that films are art. When I was 17 years old, I discovered him and went on a binge one weekend and watched all his movies, every single one, even bootleg copies I could get. I became quickly obsessed with them because I learned then that movies are art, and I started treating my approach to them completely differently.
That's amazing. Yeah, I mean, it's Carpenter. You're right. You know, a lot of times the audiences, you know, if the music's done the right way, you don't notice it, but then you do notice. I know that sounds weird, but it's done in such a way that
it becomes all one together.
Right. And that's so hard to do because, you know, we've all seen those other movies where the music kind of dominates the movie you're just like, could you tone that down, you know, turn that down a little bit. And also, you know, I hate the music that is telling me exactly when I need to be scared or, you know, when
like
I need
building
to
up a suspense build or,
Right. I mean, unless it's like a spoof or something, but that's always like that's always like the first thing you spoof, you know, is the like in Jaws or whatever. But since that time of doing the remakes and the sequels or whatever, you've launched your own series of films. Tell us about Meat Hook Massacre. Now you've done 1 through 3, but how did that initial Meat Hook Massacre 1 come to you?
Well, there's actually, we just finished part 6.
Oh.
There's 6 actually in the franchise, and there's 2 more scheduled. So there's going to be 8 total.
Now, is there an end inside? I mean, do you know if there's an end?
Yeah,
or
part 8 is the end. Part 8 is
okay.
The end. Originally, part 5 was the planned ending. Yeah, I kind of have to explain the story. So part 1 I did back actually in 2015. It was originally a work for hire that I've since regained the rights over. It was a movie that we shot on SVHS because it was meant to be a period piece as if it was a 1989 horror film. So the movie takes place in 89. All the cars are from the 80s, the outfits, everything. We shot it on VHS. And it came out that way. And then after I got the rights to that, I decided to do a sequel. And so I did part 2 that I put on Amazon Prime. And the first month, I know filmmakers talk a lot about how much they don't make, but I made like $3,000 on the first month on Meat Hook Massacre.
That's great.
Which is like an insane amount to make on Amazon Prime. So I decided then, I'm like, well, we got to make this like a franchise, at least do a couple more. So at that point, I did a comic book and I had an action figure and a Nintendo game all made. And
oh my
God. Once I did all that, of course, the popularity rose, and then I decided to commission the first one I produced, which was part 3. It was shot in Texas by Jim Duvall, and it was based on the comic book, and it was a prequel. So he went and did part 3. Then after I moved out to California, I hired John Ward in Vegas to make part 4, which is a sequel technically to 2 since 3 is a prequel. And then I made part 5 just this last spring, and that was called Meat Hook Massacre 5, The Final Chapter. It was me returning to the series. It's a sequel to part 1, like how the new Halloween is. How it's like a sequel to part 1. So it's like we follow the events. We follow up on the original character from part 1. We provide closure. And we ended it. Because the idea was, the guy that plays the killer in those movies, Robert Langford, he's Bubba in all the movies. We had an agreement that we would only do the series together. And when it ends together, you know, when it ends, we're ending it together. And he's from Lincoln. He's a Nebraska actor that was flying up here to be in himself.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, so at the end of part 5, we had a heart-to-heart because he was on his last thing here. He's about to fly back to Nebraska. And we both kind of got teary-eyed because we decided we're starting a new franchise together called Sicko the Scarecrow, and it's going to be a 3-part series. He's going to be the Scarecrow and all that. So the idea was to end Meat Hook with part 5 and move on to that. And then, so we kind of had a heart-to-heart about it, and that, you know, we were sad about Bubba being over and all that, but we're going to move ahead with Sicko the Scarecrow. And then so he goes back to Nebraska, and a little bit of time passes, and all these people are begging for a part 6. I think, like, all my fans are like, you have to do it. Like, you left that out because we left part 5 on a cliffhanger. It's supposed to be the end, but I left it on a cliffhanger. So everyone's like, oh, you got to explain that. You got to explain it. You got to explain it. I was like, well, I don't know. You know, I already told Robert he's not coming back as Bubba. I'm kind of moving on. So it started out as this project I was just simply producing. I found a different director, DeMonica Van Sant, a.k.a. Jeremiah Douglas. I was like, he was going to direct that movie. We ended up hiring someone different to play the new Bubba. And it was going to be all these things. It was going to be like a new sort of direction for it. It was taken over by new people, and I was handing it off. But then slowly, one by one, the original actress from part 2 was like, oh, I'm going to be in California. I can appear in the film if you want me to. So I ended up writing her in. And then I started involving other characters from the series. And then it became this whole thing. I was like, ugh. So I called up Robert. I was like, hey, you got to come back. We're going to do a part 6. And so it all became this thing. And at that point, I'm like, okay, now we have to set the real deadline. So the idea is we did part 6. Part 7 is part of the Scary 6, which is 6 films I'm producing in 2020. And then part 8, I'm going to return and direct, and it's a versus movie. So it'll be Bubba versus somebody, and that's how we're going to end the franchise. So I'm not going to say who.
Wow. That's amazing. Now, when you direct, do you tend to use the same DP in general, or have you worked with different ones?
Most of the time it's been me, actually. Like, for the longest time I was shooting him. But then starting around 2017, I got some bigger budgets and I started hiring more crew. And I hired Mark Timian in like 2014. And he did pretty much all my movies up until I moved here, like all through Nemesis 5. And then I came out here. I started shooting again kind of by myself. But lately, on the last couple of films, has been a guy named Matt Leal. And he is going to be part of the official lineup of SCS Entertainment, my new version of the label for next year. So he'll be my regular DP.
Oh, that's great. Now, do you find, is it more freeing for you as a director when you actually have another DP? But then I guess on the flip side, when you're just doing it all yourself, it may be, is it maybe faster and you have a little more control?
That's been my biggest struggle in my career because I go, I mean, nobody, I hate to say it without sounding like I'm bragging, but just nobody can keep up with me. You know, I go very quick. I'm very efficient. I got things very streamlined. We go out, we bang out a movie in 3 days and it's done. You know what I mean? And it's,
oh my God.
So when I'm doing a movie, I'm in the zone. You know, it's like bam, 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 we're done. No problem. And when I got a DP, I got to let them set up their shot all fancy and move this light and that light.
And, they might have an opinion or two, you know.
Yeah,
about...
they got their opinions they have to argue with. Yeah, all of that. So, I mean, it's a double-edged sword because some movies I just can't have another DP because I do so much. I do like 8 to 10 a year. And so some of those are commissioned and some of those I have fast turnarounds. So I'll have to go shoot them. But I know when I have someone like Matt or another DP, like I had Chuck Sereno shoot my shark movie. I know that when I bring in someone that's skilled in what they do, I'm going to get that much better of a looking product. So I kind of have positioned myself to save them for like the big projects because I do like, you know, 3 or 4 small films and then 3 or 4 big films.
That makes sense. And so what is your quickest turnaround when you say on some of your smaller films? What's the quickest you've shot one?
House of Pain was a 2-day movie, legitimately. We shot it on a Saturday and a Sunday, and they released it on Amazon Prime like a month later.
Oh, my God. First of all, well, I'm pitching for a job because I hate sitting around and not doing it. I love people who shoot really fast. So whenever you have like, a 2-day movie, please call me because I'm not one of those actors. You know, you hear these actors talk about they need all this time. And I'm always like, dude, really? We could just shoot this like in 3 days and be
tomorrow.
Over it.
Yeah.
I'm like really good on the first like 2 takes. And so if that's all we're going to get, then I'm
like,
all
if it's
about
good on
the
second take, move on.
I'm all about filming the rehearsal. Because sometimes that's even if you have a rehearsal, you know what I mean? But
you do a run through and people are like, oh, should we run camera? I'm like, yes, because this is good. We don't have to film anything else.
We're on the same page. We're on the same page. I love that. Now, tell us about first of all, I love the titles Horn Dogs Beach Party, which the title alone is just classic.
Yeah. So I was kind of on a kick when I moved out here that since I was next to the ocean, I really wanted to make a beach comedy because I love those, the 80s sex comedies are so much fun. And so I was like, well, I got in together with this producer, Henrik Kudo, and he had a little bit of money and he's like, well, I'll give you some money if you want to go make this film. So I made Horn Dogs Beach Party. And the basic premise of it is it's like two guys show up at an Airbnb that was wrongly booked to two girls on the same weekend that had guys' names. It's like, like the chick's name's like Andy or something like that, or, the path of the guy. So there's a little confusion. So they're forced to spend the weekend together. So of course they fall in love and hilarity ensues and all that. And it was a really fun movie. And that was another one. We shot that in 3 days. It was a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. But what sucked about that was that it's a beach comedy, and 2 of the 3 days was like the only days that year it rained in California.
Of course.
I'm like, are you kidding me? Yeah, like we literally had to run. We go inside and wait for the rain to stop, and go outside and try and shoot a scene before
Oh my god!
It was just like so much of that, so it was a very daunting experience. But the movie, the version I got to cut together and everything, I had a lot of fun. It's a great film. It really did its job as a beach comedy.
Well, and it's fun to shoot a comedy too, right? After, especially when you're been doing heavy
so
dramas
much horror.
Yeah,
definitely. It was a nice change. I like doing that. Like I do documentaries and stuff, and it changes the pace.
I mean, like I said earlier, all really good horror films usually have some comedy in them.
And I tell everybody, because everyone that's watched it, it's so funny. They're like, "So when does the killing start?" Because it literally feels like it's one of my movies without the killing. Like, it's just the jokes and the sex stuff without the deaths. It's like, this just feels like it's missing deaths or something.
Yeah, exactly. People are waiting for it. Now, what was the documentary Penny Pinchers that you did?
Okay, so I did that in 2016. Yeah, and it came out in 2017. It's there's a lot of documentaries out there about, like, 80s horror and all that stuff, but no one talks about the era of the directors that went out and shot on video, like the stuff that they were putting out themselves, like really micro budget stuff. So I got a lot of the filmmakers from the era together, like Todd Sheets and Phil Herman and Todd Jason Cook, to all come together and talk about what it was like sort of growing up in that era making films and what it's like for them today with distribution.
Right.
And so it was maybe like, I think 8 different directors in that one. And then ended up doing a part 2 a little over a year ago that had another like 8 or 10 directors in it. So it's kind of,
That. Now, where can people find that? Where can we see that? Cause that's something I want to watch.
Number one is available freaking like everywhere. I'm pretty sure number one's even on Amazon, but part 2,
just Google it. It'll come up.
Yeah. Just Google it. It's on Google Play, iTunes, all that. It should be everywhere. And then part 2 I just signed a deal with Wild Eye Releasing, so they have that. Oh, it'll be coming out from them.
Oh, great. First of all, I love documentaries. As much as I love – it's funny. I love acting in movies, and I've gotten really – I don't know if you feel this way. Sometimes people ask, why do I watch a lot of bad reality TV or documentaries? I think sometimes – I like to watch the things that I don't do for a living, so I don't really know all the ins and outs, right?
God. That's exactly like before I go on production for my movies, I have to watch usually it's like a palate cleanser, like right afterwards I have to watch a big budget Hollywood action movie. And I'll just be like, okay. You know,
right.
Like that's what I need for relief. Like, yeah, I do the same thing. I watch trashy reality TV, and I don't even really like it. I like reality TV, but I find myself watching My 600-Pound Life and Catfish all the time for that very reason.
Well, yeah, because now, you know, for me, when I watch something, here's what the actor in me does. It's so funny. Plus, I'm also old, but now I watch something and I'll be like, oh, shit, God, I wonder how long they were outside in the rain or – oh man,
that's exactly
I wonder
what
how,
I do.
You know,
I wonder.
I wonder who was sick that day. You know, or
yeah, why they had to do it this way because of that, or yeah.
Yeah, it takes. You know, I can't just like free my mind and watch something, but I do love documentaries, so I'm definitely going to watch. And I love documentaries that about the industry. So if it's directors or actors or producers, any of these kind of like Spectrum News, Spectrum One out here on the cable channels, they have something called Roundtable, and they'll have like six directors or six actors, you know, and they all discuss without being too like cheesy and discussing the process and all that. They just kind of talk about their careers. And that's one reason I love doing my show. Yeah, it's because I can talk to people like you and other actors and kind of just shoot the shit. That's how I just feel like we're sitting around and, you know, talking the biz, so to speak.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. But so I think looking ahead, and this is the other thing, I'm big about always telling people, live in the moment, enjoy the moment where you are, you know, because when I look back on my career, I was constantly trying to get to that quote, invisible next level, which really didn't exist.
Right.
I don't know what that was.
Exactly.
But you know, but we still have, we set goals for ourselves. So just looking ahead, obviously you want to keep doing what you're doing, but what's on the horizon for you? I know you've announced today about Terror at Black Tree Forest, but what else is happening?
I think, you know, really where I'm going now is just kind of becoming the next Roger Corman or Charlie Band. I mean, I don't think I really intended to do that, but I think that I'm in my 30s and I've done almost 100 movies and I have no desire to stop. You know what I mean? It's going to go for a while. So I kind of think that that's with way my company's going and producing more and bringing in all these different filmmakers, it's sort of like kind of becoming the big side of things in the indie industry. There's all these individual filmmakers, and then there's like us sort of all pooling together. So I think that it's going to grow into something, and I think that it'll be kind of grown in that direction in my future.
And I, you know, you're so right, Roger Corman. That is such a great example. And who was the second guy you mentioned, Charles?
Charles Band from Full Moon.
Oh, yeah.
Puppet
that's
Master
what,
movies, yeah. Demonic Toys, all that.
Yeah. Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I auditioned for him a few times and I really didn't know. This was some years ago. It was a movie that Master P was involved with. This is his son, Little Romeo. But I at that time, I really didn't know. I knew who Roger Corman was and I had met him and stuff, but I didn't know who Charles Band was. But that's another example where Charles is an example of a guy who has this whole prolific, you know, horror career and catalog of movies. And some people don't know him or haven't discovered him. They probably know a lot of the movies, but they just don't quite connect it. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
And so have you worked with either Roger or Charles yet?
I unfortunately haven't worked with Roger. And, you know, that's sort of like on my bucket list because I know he's getting up there in age. And so that's sort of been I have a sense of urgency about working with him.
Right,
but
right.
Charlie Band, I was very lucky to work with on the new Puppet Master movie like 3 months ago.
And how was that? Amazing?
Oh my God. Yes. It was like, you know, I mean, I'm trying to be like the next, you know, Charles Band. So like, I grew up on the Full Moon movies. Like all the Puppet Masters, all the Demonic Toys, Subspecies, all that stuff. That those were the late 80s and early 90s. That was when I was a kid and a teenager. And that was it. And so like, to me, it's sort of like the ultimate would get, you know, growing up thinking like one day you get to make one of these movies, you know, and then there I was 3 months ago on a fucking Puppet Master set. You know, it was crazy.
And it did well, and luckily it didn't disappoint, because, you know, there's that other flip side of, as we always hear, you know, sometimes when you kind of meet the people you admire, you know, sometimes they don't quite quote live up to the expectations or whatever. So it's always great when the opportunity comes and it works out in a great way. Yeah.
Well, and surprisingly, yeah, because I mean, with that situation, everybody knows he doesn't have the best reputation out there. And so I didn't know what to expect. You know, I was like, we'll see how this goes. But it was very positive. He was a great person. I cherish, I mean, to me, you know, like that's still to me the biggest thing I worked on, because it's Puppet Master and I got I got to be a victim, you know, and it was just like insane. Like I got to be in the film, and it was so much. But like you were saying, though, like on the flip side, I do a lot of music videos. I've done about 80 music videos for different bands, and almost all of them are like that, where it's like bands. It started out being bands I grew up listening to as a teenager, because what I would do is I would approach them to include their music in my film, and then as a trade, I did a music video for them. So like the first 4 or 5 years, all the music, I probably have 50 music videos I've done that were done as a trade like that. But the unfortunate thing is you get to know these bands, these people that are idols, and you find out half of them are jerks and very full of themselves. And, you know, it does ruin it, you know, and I kind of learned.
It does.
I've learned from that process, and I've actually stepped away from doing a lot of music videos just because I didn't want to keep going through that experience of like, now half the bands I used to listen to I don't like anymore because they're a jerk, you know, like.
Right.
So it's like I had to step away from that, because I found that you have to live. It's like the music industry, so it's similar but different. It's like they're their own breed of people, and you can get very wrapped into that world if you let yourself. And I kind of had to step back, and you know, I'm a horror director. Like, it's fun doing the music videos, but it's bringing me down in a lot of ways, and I have more fun doing this other thing. So it's just sort of where I'm at now.
Yeah, and I've kind of gotten this attitude now where, you know, there's rumors about all kinds of actors and directors and people's personalities. And, you know, so I try to base it. I go into projects now and I'll say, okay, I've heard about this person and maybe they're difficult, but you know what? I'm going to base it on how we interact together. And that way I'm not like surprised if it goes awry, you know, that way I'm prepared, but then I'm pleasantly surprised when it's all good and we get along and everything's great. So I try to just kind of like base it on my own experience with that individual. I mean, there are those people that it's just notoriously, you know, one horrible situation after another. Patterns. Yeah. And so, sadly,
like
some of those
in this industry, it's hard to tell though, because you don't know, it's hard to trust people, and you definitely have to form your own opinion.
Yes, of course. And I'm really bad too. Like, If someone I like, a real close friend of mine or someone I know really well has a really bad experience, that really means something to me. But there's all this like rumor stuff, like, you know, the friend of the gardener's sister's cousin, you know,
right,
had an experience or something like that 4 times removed, and those kind of things I don't put so much.
Which is all exasperated by social media today. You know, it's like harder to sift through all that.
And I wanted to I wanted to segue over to social media, because, you know, I wanted to ask you, obviously, I'm sure it plays a big part in your career in terms of marketing and fans and that kind of thing. But when you were talking about starting out making the movies look like the old VHS quality and shot, the way they were shot or whatever, this was all, of course, in the days before digital. What do you think now of how social media, what is your take, good and bad, on social media? And I guess more the internet in terms of how we have to use it in our business, or do you think we actually do have to use it?
Well, you know, it's a love hate thing, you know, like I think that the internet breeds a lot of negativity, but at the same time, the way that it is in our society now, it's a necessity. And so you kind of have to. That I think the successful filmmakers are the ones that adapt with the times. And I was late in the game getting a Facebook. I think it had been out for a few years before I was convinced to start an account. So it's like not something I was all about initially. But now it's interesting because it is such a huge part of my career. It is the main part of my career, because all my fans, all my followers, it's all through Facebook. It's all, they don't know what the hell I'm doing without my posts. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
right.
Every day, it's part of my routine. I get up about 5:30 in the morning every day, no matter what time I go to bed. And I usually start, I do about 3 posts in the morning and maybe 1 in the afternoon. It used to just be 1 a day, but it's actually grown to the point of having enough followers and growth and stuff that it has to get that way so that it can feed that fire. You know, like the more I'm doing, the more it's growing, the more people are following, and then the more I sell, the more product I have. So it's
right.
Usually I have enough content at this point. I can do 3 individual posts that aren't repeated from anything else before. And that's just how I keep it going, because then you people – with social media, it's all about branding now. Like, people,
mm-hmm.
when they hire you, they're hiring your brand. They're hiring everything that comes with you, your followers,
right.
your look, what you appeal to. And so
yeah.
people feel like they're a part of that when they can interact with you on social media. So if I go and make a post and I'm like, new movie poster coming out next month, and people are like, looks awesome. And I say, thanks, buddy. They're a fan for life.
Right.
You know, like, that's
right.
legit all you got to do. You just got to be decent, a human being to these people. And Facebook has allowed that. Like, some celebrities have other people run their pages. They post things that don't interact with their fans. But I think that is so crucial on this level to succeed,
mm-hmm.
is that you have to have people on your side. People have to feel like, oh, I know him. He's my friend. I want to support him. I want to go
right.
buy his video today because he talked to me. You know, like,
right.
that's the attitude. I think that social media makes it good for.
And also, like you've done, like I have, when you do any sort of conventions or fan conventions, you know, that's when you really see how committed a lot of the fans are. And of course, the first
yeah.
thing we do is we connect on Instagram or Facebook or Twitter.
Right.
You know, you take a photo and you immediately are connected. Yeah, I find, you know, I'm like you. I didn't really start until I did a movie called MacGruber, and I think it was 2010. And I was way late, and I, you know, but I'm 55 now, and I'm determined I'm not going to be that old person that's left in the dust on technology. And,
right.
and I'm not technically naturally apt at it, you know, and I don't have a great aptitude
yeah.
for it, but these actors and these producers and directors who are always kind of poo-pooing it and, oh, I don't, you know, it's so ridiculous. And you guys are over-promoting, and I'm like you, I get so much work from people reaching out to me on social media. And
yeah,
so
it's where it
I
all
think
comes it's from.
It's where it all comes from. And like I said, Bill Oberst Jr. and I were talking. Bill's big on the marketing, and you know, he got a lot of pushback as well from people saying, you know, I'm so tired of seeing your post
yeah.
about this and that. I'm like, well, you know what? Don't follow me.
You're not buying my movie anyway, so sorry. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, I think it's amazing. I think it's a great way that we can stay connected and get work and put the content out there. So
well, and the people who are really in the industry getting work, they understand that. You know, the people that make those kind of comments, they're not there, and that's why.
They're in their mom's basement with no picture
yeah.
on their Twitter
yeah,
profile.
Exactly.
So yeah, I guess what do you say, like, when beginning filmmakers approach you today, you know, cause I get this a lot from actors, like, you know, what advice do I give young actors? I'm just curious, cause there's so many avenues now that people can do to start, but what would you say to, like, you know, new filmmakers, people wanting to get into the industry?
I tell everybody to not hesitate and don't second guess themselves, because
right.
the hardest thing in the beginning is people wanting to resist you. Like, they don't want you. Nobody, people that are, I hate using this word, but people in the basic world, if they know you as a fellow person that they've grown up with, they will naturally be jealous at your success if you pass them in life. And so
right.
it's hard starting out as an artist, because you're faced with your friends and family that you had your whole life, and you go through that whole ordeal. And so a big part of it, I think, is to follow your instincts and your gut, you know, if you want to do it, and don't let anything technically stop you. Like, a lot of people think, oh, well, I don't have a $6,000 camera, and I don't have a sound guy. And I don't have, it's like, shoot it on your cell phone. Shoot it with your brother in your backyard with a flashlight. Do something
mm-hmm.
to get started, because
right.
you have to start somewhere to be able to continue going. Until you go and shoot that first thing, you're still at the same level.
Exactly. That's right. I tell actors that too. I say, you know, just act wherever you are. You don't have to be in New York
yeah.
or LA. Just act, and don't turn down any jobs. do every job you can.
Like, Lion's Guy ain't gonna come knocking down your door, you know. Like, you gotta go out there and do, like, so you gotta work, make work for yourself.
Right, and you have to have a passion for it, you know. And I always say to people, if there's anything you can do besides this and be happy, you really should go do it. I mean, that's true in life. Life is so short. Why waste time doing something that you're not 100% committed to anyway?
And the sad thing is, that's what everybody does. You know what I mean? Like,
I know.
What, 10% of society, of us, that goes and pursues their dreams? And that means about 90% of society just works a 9-to-5, and they think that that's all that they can achieve in life. And that, to me, is like, that's my my sense of urgency every single day. Is like, I could never live a life like that. I could never imagine that's my purpose, is to just exist and pay bills to, like, die. What the hell? No.
I know.
Like, I don't want to live like that. Like, I want to be happy. I want to have some money to do some nice things. I want to be known for my talent and creativity. Like, you know, it blows my mind that I feel like there's not more people that do try harder, but that's just the sad truth.
Well, and you want a quality of life, you know. That's why I think it's so smart that you lived outside of LA. Because, I mean, Dustin, listen, you know, I mean, the homeless situation is out of control in LA, but we know those artists and those actors and people, they can't make it. They're struggling in LA, and they just won't move. They won't leave the city and go 30 miles outside. I don't know if it's,
I know,
there's
it's
something about they
have with everybody.
It's like, they feel like they have to say they're living in Hollywood, which is, it's really
almost like
sad,
out of spite.
Because,
like, well, I'm here and I just got to stay here. You know, it's just like, but you'd be so much better off saving money, you know, coming when you just need the work. Like, it doesn't
Make sense. No, you're right. It's like it's like the kid stomping its feet, you know, but I'm going to stay here. And, you know, that's great. I mean, then shut the hell up and stop complaining about.
Yeah, that you're so broken not getting roles, you know.
And how expensive it is. And because, you know, the truth is, this is the old man talking, but, you know, it goes by really fast. And suddenly you wake up and you're 50, nothing against 50, but you wake up and you're 50 and you're going, what do I have to show for this? And
exactly.
what kind of quality of life do I have? So, and the greatest thing about being an artist is, you know, we want to keep inspiring people. I remember when I first moved to LA, I did a lot of temp work, and like you said, I can remember on Monday mornings, like, the elevator doors would open and people would walk in like, hey everybody, you know, it's Monday. And then Wednesday would come and they're like, oh, hey, it's hump day. And then Friday, everyone's jumping around. I'm thinking, you're just wishing away days of your life to get to the weekend.
Yeah. Yeah,
I
exactly.
Know.
I always talk about that. And people don't realize they do that. It's like they're racing through the horrible work week to get to the 2 days when they can have fun in life. And it's like, you know, you could do that with your whole life if you just worked a little harder and pursued your dreams. You know, but it's just easier to just go work a 9-to-5 and get married, have the white picket fence, pay the bills till you die.
Right. And just kind of settle.
Yeah.
That's what people are taught, you
grow up believing that that's what you're supposed to do.
That's what you're supposed to do. Right. That's right. And it's, you know, and listen, there are times growing when I was out here and I would watch my friends getting married, and, like, before I was really doing well or anything, you know, they'd be buying the houses and having the kids. And there's always that part of me is like, ugh, God, I'm sort of, you know, I was a little not jealous, but, you know, I actually was happy for them because I thought, this is great that they're having this kind of peaceful quality of life. But on the flip side, I'm like you, I just knew I had to be pursuing this business. So that's,
well, and you know, they're divorced now and got 3 kids and are in debt. Like, so who cares?
Well, I don't know if you've done any high school reunions. Let's see. I guess you've had probably a 10-year, right?
I've never gone to one. I think that there was one, yeah, but I didn't go.
Okay. Because those are always, I mean, really, that should be documentaries, because those are eye opening in so many ways, where you go, wow, this is what's happened. And then the person that you probably least expected to, quote, do a certain thing, you know, they're in this whole other world. That's so fascinating. So, well, anyone just tuning in, again, we've got the wonderful Dustin Ferguson here, and you can follow Dustin on Facebook. Everything is Dustin Ferguson. You could check out his IMDb page, Google him. You can see all the all the catalog of work he's already done and all the stuff that's coming up. Dustin, the time flies by so much, but I wanted to thank you so much for taking the time to do the show. I really hope one day we can work together. That would be amazing.
Yeah, I would love to. I definitely want to work with you, for sure. Hit me up.
Absolutely. And a big shout out again to Joe Williamson and also to Vita Gafari. How much do we love her? And I know you guys have worked together.
Oh, yeah, I love Vita. Yeah, she's in lots of movies. I love her.
I know. She's part of your repertoire, your company. Yeah. Well, listen, buddy, have a great rest of your night. And thank you again. And we'll see you soon.
You as well. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Take care.
Day.
Take care. Wow. What a great guy. What a great interview with Mr. Dustin Ferguson. This has been amazing. Well, guys, listen, just remember, follow us on social media. Once again, I love interacting with all of you and getting your messages. I'm so thankful for all of your support of our film, Anyone Home, the Gravitas Ventures released it last month in November. We've been getting great reviews. We've been getting great interviews. I'm so proud of this film. Big shout out to director and writer Patrick Cunningham, co-writer and producer Will Frank, and the whole cast and the whole crew. It was really a labor of love. This was a long time coming. We worked for many, many years on this project, and I'm so happy that it's sort of touching a chord with people. It kind of really does touch on the housing situation, on mental illness, on just where we are in the society now with the have and the have-nots. And I was really, really honored to work with the cast, Monique Gabriella Kernan and Luke Ganlon, who plays the young boy. He's phenomenal in this movie. He really has to carry 90% of the film along with Monique. And all of my scenes are with both of them. I'm so excited for the whole team. And this is, you will be seeing much more work from Patrick Cunningham, the director. And then, as if I haven't had enough great stuff happening, I have a second film, Captured, that's opening on January 1st, 2020. And some wonderful press has already started on that. And that is from Green Apple Entertainment. Joe Arias is, again, another first-time director. I love working with these young, passionate directors. I get to play Shelley, who's kind of the creepy groundskeeper in the movie, surrounded by this phenomenal, kick-ass young group of actors that play members of a rock band, Brittany Coran, Christine Prout, just a whole amazing group of actors. And they go back to the lead singer's home to shoot a music video. And a lot of creepy stuff happened in the past there. And Shelley kind of shows up as sort of a keeper of secrets. And it's kind of a red herring in the movie. And it was, again, another long process that took a few years to come together and reshoots and true in the trenches indie filmmaking. But again, I've seen the movie. I'm so proud of it. That's going to be dropping on the 1st. So again, I also want to shout out to my agents at NCA and Associates, Joy Purvis in Atlanta, Newman Thomas Management, the wonderful Joe Williamson, PR. I'm now also working with October Coast PR, who've been doing a lot of press as well. I'm really blessed. And as we go into this holiday season, I just want to thank everyone that works with me, Mr. John Williams, Brandon Brewer, big shout out to Dennis Tyrone, of course, the main person in my life, to my family, all my cousins and relatives. And next Wednesday, I'm going to be having neck surgery. I'm having two discs replaced. And I will only be down for, say, a week or so. But we have tons of archive shows already in the can, ready to go. So, listen, we will see you on the next episode. I can't thank you enough for following us for the last 8 years. It's been amazing. Shout out, peace, love to all of you. And until we see each other at the next show, God bless. Take care.
Thanks for checking out One-on-One with Jasper Cole. Check out past episodes and get the latest as they're released. Subscribe today on iTunes, Stitcher, and YouTube.